Welcome to Vital Voices. The late Gordon Lightfoot wrote that Lake Superior never gives up her dead when the gales of November come early. Indeed, 29 men perished on November 10, 1975, when a ship called the Edmund Fitzgerald went down during a confluence of horrible storms. The story of the ship and her crew is brilliantly told by John U. Bacon in his new book, The Gales of November. John Bacon is our guest today on Vital Voices. John Bacon, congratulations on the publication of The Gales of November. It's a remarkable book and one of my favorite nonfiction works from 2025.
Well, that's high praise, Fred. Thank you very much.
Let's start out with the Gordon Lightfoot song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which is the touchstone, really, when it comes to thinking about the sinking of the ship for most of us. Explain the sort of unconventional way in which Lightfoot went about writing and recording that song.
Well, let's not kid ourselves. No song, no book. You have to be humble enough to recognize that. How about this, Fred? There are 1875 to 1975 on the Great Lakes, there were 6,000 commercial shipping shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. That's one per week, every week for a century. 30,000 crew lost. That's one per day, every day for a century. And everybody knows one. And the reason they know one at all is because of Gordon Lightfoot's song. So without that, there is no book. It's a very unlikely song to be created and to be a hit. He wrote the song starting the night it went down. The ship went down on November 10th, 1975. I still talk to people in line at book tour stops who think that the song was fictional or that it was from, you know, the 1850s. But what happens is this. He's working on the song. He's got a couple great articles in the Associated Press and Newsweek magazine, who had so many good lines, he used them in his song. Both those guys are still alive, and I got to them, Harry Atkins and Jim Gaines. But he's very self-conscious about the song, kind of the way I was about the book. There are a lot of ways to screw this up. You can come across as too sentimental, sensationalistic, inaccurate, a lot of things like this. So he kind of kept the song to himself. And then 5 months later, they're in March of 76, they're in a Toronto studio working on his next album, Summertime Dreams. He's got 11 songs ready to go. This is not one of them. They got 5 days to record these songs. And after 3.5 days, they finish them all because they're a very tight, organized band and they know what they're doing. And then Gordon Lightfoot is literally saying to his bandmates, thanks for coming down. Great job. You know, see you later. They're packing up their instruments. And that's when Kevin in the sound booth, the producer, he says, why don't you try that song you've been screwing around with? And he says, it's not ready. He says, well, look, man, I'm charging you for 5 days, whether you play anymore or not. The band's here. We're here. Why not give it a shot? So he gets talked into it. He asks them to turn the lights down low to get in the mood. Like a minute, he's quiet, trying to recapture what this felt like. And the drummer, Barry Keane, is also still alive. I got very lucky repeatedly in this book. He's 24 years old back then. He's a rookie drummer. And he says, what do you want me to do? He's never heard the song. And Lightfoot says, I'll give you a nod when I want you to come in. And Barry says, okay, fine. So after a minute and a half, he's not nodded to Barry Keane. And Keane thinks, this song's about to end, and he's forgotten all about me. Nope. At 1:34, he nods to Barry Keane. Barry Keane comes in with the drum solo, basically. It's a pretty gutsy move for a rookie drummer. And you cannot hear the song without it. Your brain will fill it in when you get to that part, trust me. And they finish the song at 6:28, they say, you know what? That wasn't half bad. Let's try it again. You know, Kevin recorded this time, so he does. They tried it again, not as good. They tried it again, not as good. They tried it 5 more times that day, 10 more times the next day, their off day, and it was never quite as good. And finally, the guy in the booth, Kevin, says, you know what? I recorded that first one. Let's play it back. So they do, and they all agreed that was the best version. So the song you hear on the radio on this one, Fred, it's not just a first take. Those happen once in a while. It was the first time the band had ever played the song, had ever rehearsed it. And as Barry Keane says, first takes happen once in a blue moon. First time you ever played it, never, ever, 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 ever. And I said, why did it happen this time? And he said, because this is not a song that you think your way through, not a technical exercise. This is a song that you have to feel. We felt it the strongest the first time. The song you hear on the radio to this day is the first time the band had ever even played it, which is incredible. What's more incredible is it becomes a hit. They're on Saturday Night Live later on that spring. They're on the Midnight Special, the old Friday Night Concert Show. So they play 3 songs for SNL. They play 6 songs for Friday Night Special, Midnight Special, and they don't play this song. I think there's no way in hell this can be a hit. It's too long. It's 6 minutes. There's no chorus. There's no guitar solo. There's none of the hook you have to make a hit. And yet it crawls up the charts bit by bit, week by week, and it finishes the year at number 2 behind Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night about his hot Swedish girlfriend, Britt Eklund, cooing in the background. That was the 70s, people, trust me. And this song was a very unlikely hit, and Gordon Lightfoot considered it the best song of his career.
It's even a crossover hit. I remember playing it during my days as a country disc jockey.
Gotta love that. That shows you. I mean, Canada, U.S., across the world, it was a hit. Very shockingly.
One of the things that really impressed me about the late Gordon Lightfoot is the fact that he kept in touch with several of the families who lost loved ones in that wreck.
He did, and he did that intentionally. He also changed the lyrics a couple times when he found more facts, small facts, but he changed the lyrics out of respect. Became very close to the families. They all had his number. He had theirs. Even Ruth Hudson, the mother of Bruce Hudson, her only child, a 22-year-old deckhand, when she was on her deathbed, he calls her up. And she says, I promised the day before the 40th anniversary of the sinking. She said, I promised Bruce by prayer that I would join him in heaven before the 40th anniversary. He's been alone too long. So she tells this to Gordon Lightfoot. And he got off the phone with tears in his eyes. That photo is in the book, actually. And a few hours later, she passed away. But and she said before she did, she said to Bruce Hudson's girlfriend, the mother of his child, I was talking to Gordon. That's how close they were. And Gordon Lightfoot gave some money for a scholarship in their name, the Great Lakes Maritime Academy. He is truly one of the heroes of this story.
Absolutely. You touched on this a bit, but talk more about how dangerous shipping had been on Lake Superior, on the Great Lakes, prior to the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and give us an idea of the number of people who had died on ships on those lakes prior to November of 1975.
Well, look, I grew up in the Great Lakes, man. I live in Michigan. I've swam in all of them. I've sailed in a couple of them, but I had no idea. You talk to the experienced Great Lakes sailors, and by that I mean the commercial freighter guys, they'll tell you that the Great Lakes are actually more dangerous than the Atlantic. And I thought that's impossible, but you talk to the experts, and they'll tell you it's true. One reason is salt water. Salt water weighs down the ocean waves a little bit, takes the point off, spreads them out. But more importantly, on the ocean, the waves you get are probably from a storm 500 or 1,000 miles away. By the time the waves get to you, they're smooth and soft, like a roller coaster. Still dangerous, don't get me wrong about that, of course. But on the Great Lakes, they're sharp and pointy, like a mountain range, and they're twice as close together. They're not 10 to 16 seconds apart. They're 4 to 8 seconds apart. Mm-hmm. And why does that matter? That means you can get your bow in one wave, and then 700 feet later, because that's how long these things are, you can get your stern in another 30-foot wave with nothing in the middle. And except, of course, what you're carrying, which happens to be 26,000 tons of taconite, which is iron ore. Mm-hmm. That's the equivalent of 4,200 adult elephants, which means what? It means your ship can crack like 2 sawhorses holding your ship up with the 2 waves and nothing in the middle. So your ship can crack in the middle. That's what happened to the Bradley in 1958 and the Morrell in 1966. And we've got chapters on both of those in this book. So it can be incredibly dangerous, and the big reason for that, it turns out, is that instead of storms being 1,000 miles away on the Great Lakes, what's called locally occurring systems. And I said, what does that mean? He said, it means the storm's over your damn head. I said, okay, mm-hmm. I got that. So surprisingly, the Great Lakes for a commercial shipper can be more dangerous. As I said earlier, 6,000 shipwrecks, that's the low estimate, from 1875 to 1975, that's one per week. 30,000 crew loss, that's one per day. These are crazy, crazy numbers. That's how dangerous it is.
We'll get back to weather conditions in a minute, but let's talk about the person, Edmund Fitzgerald, he was, of course, a real person. Explain who he was, why the ship was named after him, and tell us what took place as the ship was being christened by Edmund Fitzgerald's wife.
Sure. Edmund Fitzgerald was a real person. A lot of folks don't realize that. A very unlikely person in some ways. He was the CEO of Northwestern Mutual Insurance, which I know you can get in your area. They're a $20, $31 billion company now. So why is he asking for the greatest freighter in the history of the Great Lakes? Because his grandfather was a Great Lakes captain, and his five great uncles were all Great Lakes captains. That's six. There are only 300 Great Lakes captains. So one family has 2%. That has got to be a record. So he grew up with it, basically. And he asked for the greatest ship that had ever been born on the Great Lakes. It was. It was the longest at 729 feet. It could carry the most cargo. It was one of the fastest. It broke every record on the Great Lakes for 15, 16 years. So it was the best and the most luxurious. How about that? Mm-hmm. J.L. Hudson's, the old department store, you might know Dayton Hudson's. They outfitted the ship with carpeted floors, with wood-paneled walls, with tiled bathrooms, air conditioning, and TV in 1958, when even hotels in the north, at least, didn't have those things. So it was spectacular by all accounts. But the day it launched, on June 7th, 1958, in Detroit, and they drew 15,000 fans, more than the Detroit Tigers that day. How about that? Helen Fitzgerald, his wife, was supposed to christen the ship, of course, with a bottle of champagne, a Magnum bottle, and it took her three whacks to actually break the bottle. Sailors are automatically superstitious. That is bad voodoo, and that's where the bad luck starts.
You write in great detail about the shipping industry on the Great Lakes. Give us an idea of how vital Great Lakes shipping was and is to the nation's economy.
Well, I appreciate your very smart questions, Fred, and obviously you've read the book very carefully and got out some good insights. I didn't know how dangerous the Great Lakes were. I didn't know how important Great Lakes shipping is, and I've seen these ships go by my entire life, so shame on me. 95% of what's in that book are materials I did not know 4 years ago when I started. Well, guess what? Turns out that trains are three times more efficient than trucks, and Great Lakes ships are six times more efficient than trucks. Twice as efficient as trains. So not 6% better than trucks or 60% better than trucks, 600% more efficient than trucks. It's not even close. So that's why the cement in your basement, the iron in your car and steel in your house, and the food in your table, it all comes from these ships. And I truly had no idea. And the reason I had no idea, there are only 9,000 sailors, 30 per ship, 300 ships back then. That's 9,000 spread out over eight states. You're not going to meet these guys. And, Fred, even if they live next door to you, you're still not going to meet them because they're on a ship 9 months out of the year. Back then, no breaks, no weddings, no funerals, no graduations, no anniversaries. None of it mattered. These guys get on a ship in April, and they come off in January. And as one of my experts said, I'm very close to all three of my kids. I love them dearly, but I didn't teach any of them how to ride a bike. And that's got to break your heart. So, as one of my experts said, we all know the farmer and the factory worker and the miner, but nobody knows the Great Lakes sailor, and that's why.
All right, let's talk about weather conditions. Describe the intersection of the weather systems in November of 1975 that led to the Edmund Fitzgerald's sinking.
Well, if you want to talk about a perfect storm, we've got one here. And if Sebastian Younger hadn't used that great line for his book, I'd try to use it for this one. So, the gales of November, you guys know in eastern Tennessee, of course, in that region with the hurricanes. When is it worst? September, for you guys, because that's when the ocean is warm and the air turns cool. The same thing happens in the Great Lakes in November. The water's still warm and the air is cold. And at that day, November 9th, when they launch in Duluth, Minnesota, near Superior, where they took off, it was 70 degrees that Sunday. You think that's great news? That's bad news. The longer winter takes to arrive, the nastier it shows up. And in this case, you've got a winter storm from Alberta, Canada, Western Canada, coming in, bringing dry, cold winds, of course. They're used to that one. They didn't know there's another storm coming out of the southwest, not too far from you, called the Panhandle Hooker. How about that name, Fred? It's called that because it hooks around the panhandles of Oklahoma and Texas, and then in this case heads on up to Lake Superior. These two systems, one cool dry air, one hot wet air, collide right in front of Whitefish Bay. Whitefish Bay is the easternmost point of Lake Superior. It is the drain of the bathtub. It is Lake Superior. That's where all the waves hit and so on. It's going to set up shop like a catcher right in front of Whitefish Bay, and that's just what this ship's going to run into. So that's bad news for the ship.
Let's talk about the captain of that ship, Ernest McSorley. He seems to have been a competent and very responsible captain, and one who commanded great respect and loyalty from his crew members. What kind of person was he?
Well, you hit the right notes there, Fred. He was 63 years old, lived in Toledo, Ohio, right here on Lake Erie. He had been a Great Lakes captain since he was 31, the youngest at the time on the Great Lakes out of 300. That tells you something about how good he was. And I heard from his rivals in this book that he was, in fact, the best captain in the Great Lakes, and it wasn't even close. The best in rough weather, the most aggressive. He never turned around or laid anchor, which the company in Cleveland, they liked that. But he's also the best pilot. And what does that mean? I got to six guys who'd been in the ship before it went down, obviously, and they all said the same thing about McSorley. One of them told me, I saw that man park 729 feet of steel, the ship, in other words, between two other freighters with 5 feet on either side at the docks in Two Harbors, Minnesota, and he didn't touch a damn thing like he's parallel parking his Ford F-150 pickup truck. Hmm. That's how good he was. And as you also said, too, in an era when these captains were often tyrants, and they could be, they could throw hot coffee on their crew. They're pretty nasty for the most part, egomaniacs. This guy was the opposite. He was so considerate and soft-spoken with his crew that they followed him from ship to ship to ship, and including his final appointment on the best ship on the Great Lakes, the Emma Fitzgerald. So he knew these guys for 15, 20 years. And five of them, including him, all decided to come back for one last season before they retired. And this is going to be it.
John Bacon, thank you for joining us for Vital Voices.
Fred, thank you so much. And I got to tell you, and I know you're in East Tennessee, long way away from the Great Lakes, the book has done much better outside of the Great Lakes and with female readers than we ever expected. So thanks to all you folks down there as well.
And we'll continue our conversation with John Bacon next week on Vital Voices. The book is The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. For Vital Voices, I'm Fred Sossman.